Well, Studebaker years started out in March of 53, and the very first thing I was put on was a rear deck lid nameplate that was to be combined with the deck lid release handle. And
what
was to be the 54 Studebaker? A very minor facelift over the 53, mm-hmm. which by now you, of course, remember is the designer's design, Bob Burke's crowning glory.
Mm-hmm.
Some people called it a funny car when I left Ford. I remember Damon Woods referring to it as a funny car. But I didn't think it was funny, and a lot of other people didn't think it was funny. We thought it was the best-looking American car yet, certainly in the post-war era. In some ways, I liked the Studebaker approach. They didn't make so many sketches and plaster the walls with sketches. They were more interested in getting a design out than in putting on a show for management. One aspect of the Studebaker approach that I did not care for, they didn't go much for line drawings. This was primarily because I think Lowy didn't really understand a line drawing.
You might give us just a brief précis of the design administrative setup there as you found it when you got to South Bend.
Well, Raymond Lowy Associates had the Studebaker design account, and all Studebaker styling was done by Raymond Lowy Associates, who were assigned space in the Chippewa truck plant, spacious quarters there.
This is Chippewa Street, isn't it?
Yeah, Chippewa Street in South Bend. It was where Studebaker made aircraft engines and army trucks during the war. It was built for the war. And my paycheck and that of everybody else in the styling department came from Raymond Lowy Associates, not from Studebaker.
Unique arrangement.
Of course, Studebaker paid for it.
Yeah.
As you'll read in Burke's book, everything Lowy paid was marked up 100%, and that's how Lowy got his commission.
Unprecedented, I think, in the industry at that time.
I guess so. I don't know what kind of, the closest parallel I can think of prior to that time was George Walker with Nash, and what arrangement he had, I don't know. But anyway, Raymond Lowy spent most of his time in New York or Paris, and his resident manager in South Bend was Bob Burke, who was a very capable designer. And Lowy was really no designer himself, although he was very good on graphics. He was certainly no designer, but he did have a flair. He recognized good design, and he had a talent for surrounding himself with good designers. Bob Burke was a resident manager, and he was the boss there in the South Bend office of the Raymond Lowy Associates, which in effect was the Studebaker styling department.
Burke was a rather benign, a firm but understanding boss, wasn't he?
I would say so, yes. Yeah. He was a good man. I have no. If there were any problems between he and myself, I'm afraid I would have to take the major blame. Those edges I alluded to weren't really polished off yet.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Bob with fondness and affection. But I, as I said, I didn't really care for their approach. They didn't really understand the value of line elevation drawings. And I think the final sweetening of a line has to be done on paper, not in three dimension, because you don't really see it in three dimension as readily.
You mentioned earlier that you thought that was due to the peculiar orientation of
Lowy. Well, perhaps Burke too, because Burke hadn't had any experience at any other automotive company, and he came in fresh from Sears Roebuck, and if he'd had his training at GM or even the old Ford, he would have probably drawn these things on a blackboard full size before going to the full size clay.
You think this is a
even Studebaker in the pre-Lowy days did it this way. I'm not saying that that way is sufficient. You have to have the three-dimensional clay too to prove it out. But if it looks good in a side elevation line drawing, I say that it'll look good in clay. It'll look even better in clay. But if you go directly to clay,
directly from what to clay?
A sketch,
right.
or a scale model.
Yeah.
Well, the Lowy days were rather short-lived because I started March 54 and
in
53.
You adapted yourself to this situation, at least temporarily.
Well, not fully. I never became a good sketch artist.
Okay.
So I became more oriented toward clay.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to present my ideas in clay if possible.
Really in self-defense.
Yeah. And
this had been the root of Bob Cotto, hadn't it?
Yeah.
And perhaps Ted Pye should
do. No, Ted was pretty much a rendering man.
Was he? Okay.
And lines too.
Yeah. Say the Lowy days were numbered at this point. What year was this?
I started in March 53, and Lowy was, his contract was terminated or failed to be renewed in sometime in, I would have to guess, I would say early 55.
Did he scuttlebutt around the shop as to why this happened?
Well, sure. Jim Nance, who headed up Packard,
James J. Nance.
That's right. Was not an automobile man. He was an appliance man and a salesman.
It's kind of like George Walker.
Yeah.
Although he didn't.
As such, he didn't really appreciate the stuff, the good stuff that Lowy had done and was capable of doing. And also this stuff, as you may recall, didn't sell as well as it should. But not because of the styling, in my opinion. It was because Studebaker was doing such a bum job of building these cars. And they had we called it the rubber band frame. I mean, styling is important, but it's not gonna overcome poor workmanship or poor engineering. And Studebaker had both. But styling was the scapegoat. And Nance was more oriented to Detroit styling, which was the razzmatazz extruded school by that time, you know, filling out the cube, which it reached its nadir in with the 57 Mercury, in my opinion. This was the all-time low design of anybody's car that anybody ever made. 58 Buick was close, but I give the dubious honor to the 57 Mercury.
You call this escape designing? Or did I misunderstand?
I said it was the nadir, the low point.
Before that you mentioned something like
that. I don't recall.
Okay.
The ultimate expression of the Detroit school then, the emerging Detroit school.
Which you would characterize as the nadir.
The nadir, yeah.
N-A-D-I-R.
N-A-D-I-R, yeah.
Right,
yeah. I hope I'm using the word rightly.
That's correct.
It's
opposite would be apogee.
Right. And a Studebaker, on the other hand, the 53 Studebaker represented, really represented Italian styling in a way, at its best. It wasn't Italian styling, it was good styling. I hate these names applied to styling, because Detroit styling can, and at one time was, the best. But by the mid-50s, I don't feel it was anymore. The Italians were by far the leaders. And Detroit was getting more vulgar by the model. And for somebody who knows nothing about cars, I guess the 57 Mercury might have been pretty attractive. I don't know. But now I think you'll find pretty universal agreement that it was pretty bad. But we, some of us so-called purists at that time, were increasingly becoming a voice in the wilderness. Well, that's one reason Nance thought that the boys he could find in Detroit were better. Maybe Bill Schmidt had already done a job on him, I don't know. At any rate, Schmidt was his man.
And Packard came from Packard too, hadn't
he? Well, he went with Packard when Nance took over.
Yeah.
So, when I heard Schmidt was coming down to South Bend, I was a mighty dejected individual. He came in with all his sketches of extruded stovepipe designs, which now are out, thank goodness, out of fashion again. Of course, Bill, his type, they're very, as he puts it, they bend with the wind, they bend with the breeze, and they would adapt themselves very readily to whatever way the breeze is blowing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they'll present themselves as the foremost proponent of whatever happens to be the current trend. If I sound a little bitter there, I apologize. But shortly put, Nance felt that he and his Detroit crew could do a better job, maybe for less money. And so they brought Bill Schmidt in with McRae, Duncan McRae. Bill the overall head, and Duncan the head over the Studebaker operation, the branch manager, as it were. So here I'm proving myself over and over again to a new crowd, and it really was getting pretty tiresome. I was trying to be more diplomatic, maybe by force of circumstance, than I had been in the past, and I didn't have any problems with Bill.
You're learning to play the game, by this
way. Yes, learning to play the game, I guess. That's a good way of putting it. I was given a goodly amount of freedom by Duncan also.
That's good.
I think I was fairly highly regarded.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they didn't like me, but they tolerated me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, Studebaker went through a lot of convulsions shortly after that period. I remember Bill coming around shaking hands with everybody, and me included, telling me he was quitting, going back to Detroit, quitting Studebaker Packard. I think he saw the handwriting on the wall. The one thing I will not accuse Bill of being, and he's not a dummy.
He can read.
He's really okay. I mean, I don't feel bad about Bill that way. But anyway,
nice guy, personally.
Yeah. Very smooth, though.
Oh yeah.
Anyway.
As you say, a sales trip.
Yeah. He and Jean Bordenay, I have always kind of thought of as birds of a feather. But at least, as I said before, I didn't consider them evil men. So Schmidt quit, and McRae was then in charge of everything, and
At this point, all the galaxy have left. Burke,
I think,
Loewy, or did Burke stay on for a while?
No, Burke left when the Loewy contract was over.
How about Ted? Ted Peach?
He stayed. He stayed.
How about Bob Cotto?
No, he left.
He left.
Cotto left with Loewy. Andrews left with Loewy.
Oh, okay.
And Cucho left with Loewy.
Uh-huh.
But within 2 months, they were all dispersed on their own because Loewy had nothing to keep them going.
Right.
You'll read that in Burke's book. So McRae took over the Studebaker.
Duncan, a likable guy with talent?
Yes, I would have to say so. I hesitated because I know I was not one of his favorites. Duncan was also fond of the grape, as you put it, and in his case it was quite obvious.
Mm. Maybe no more.
And he was also very much a, call it a ladies' man if you want. You could call it other things too. He had his little crew of close associates, you know, drinking buddies.
Who would they be at that point?
Well, Bill Bonner was one. And I like Bill, I have nothing against him.
But sure.
I'm just telling you, I wasn't in on Duncan's inner circle.
Yeah.
Bill Bonner and a fellow named Byron Brown and Bert Holm, I believe his name was. To a lesser extent, maybe Ray Everts. It seems to me I've read that Ray has made it big at Ford here since then. I don't know if it's the same Ray Everts or not.
E-V-E-R-T-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but to his credit, Duncan did let me go my own way on. He let me make 2 full-size clay model, or quarter-size clay models, which I really enjoyed making and strictly to my own design. They had very little to do with production, but it didn't matter much at that time because Studebaker didn't have any money to put into some new models anyway. We were all kind of floundering,
yeah.
Killing time.
Oh, yes. Chaotic period.
It was very chaotic.
The
then Curtis Wright came in, and Nance and Packard dropped out of the picture, and Curtis Wright came in, and Duncan developed the 59 Lark, pretty much.
Pretty much his conception?
I would say so. I'd say so because I saw him design something like that, very much like that, when he was at Ford. A sketch of his, and I admired it then.
Mm-hmm.
Radiator type grill,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, real honest grill in front of
right.
the radiator core.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was very nice. I read somewhere where he attributed the front end to Bill Bonner. But, it was my impression that it was Duncan's design. Anyway, he needed an alternative design so management would feel. Excuse me, that they had a choice. You know, you never like to present management with a design and say, here, this is it. They like to have at least 2 to choose from so they felt they made a good choice. And Duncan let me work out the other full-sized one, which in this case was, he denied this later, and I think he resented my saying so, but in this case, the other car was, quote unquote, the other one, the one that was slated to be the fall guy.
Right.
Because I put a front end on this that was based on one of these clay models he had let me make. And it was quite a nice front end, I thought. And I had Larry Brahm, our woodworker, make up a wooden grill for it. And at the last minute, when these 2 models were to be shown, he had this grill taken out of it, or he wouldn't allow me to put it in. And he put in, instead, a plain wire mesh gravel screen, of course, you know, regular perforated metal, real cheap looking thing. Looked like hell.
Who didn't allow you to do that?
Duncan.
Okay.
I brought this up to one of these writers for these magazines, and I explained that I didn't really say it bitterly. I said he needed another design, and I'm sure that he didn't want this thing I was working on to be chosen, so he made it unattractive. He should have been honest with me, though, and just told me, look, we're trying to sell this one, and, but I guess it isn't done that way. Well, anyway, they picked the other one, and I feel in this case it was the better one. They picked the right lark, and I think it was a damn good job, given that they had to work around this old 53 body. So I guess you have an inkling of how I feel about Duncan. I think he was a capable designer. His designs had flair, and he had respect for me, but I don't think he liked me. And I guess that pretty well sums it up. I didn't have any respect for his personal life either, but it's none of my business, so. So that's the way it was. So then, after the 59 Lark came out, and Churchill thought that was the Studebaker's Volkswagen, in other words, something they'd never change, as people thought they'd never change the Beetle, you know, it just went on and on and on.
This is Harold Churchill, who is
yes.
who has come to the presidency of Studebaker.
He was president at that time. So Duncan said he quit because, well, really, in effect, Churchill wouldn't have much need for his services for the foreseeable future. And he went to work with Curtis Wright. And I don't think this really says much for his intelligence, but he went to work for Curtis Wright over at back at the Chippewa plant again, which Curtis Wright had took over.
Are they taking over the Chippewa plant?
I believe so.
To do what?
Well, I think they were continuing to make trucks there.
Curtis Wright was making the old Studebaker trucks?
I'd better not say on here. I don't want to say if I don't know.
But they were in some form of the automobile business.
I don't know if they had the whole plant or not, but I just know that Duncan had a maybe the old Studebaker styling department out there.
Okay.
And he took his buddies with him, and they were allegedly, or they went out there with the thought that they were going to design ground effects aero cars, you know, these fan cars with the fans that shoot a fan toward the, well, they've got the same principle going over the English Channel now, these hovercraft.
Okay.
Curtis Wright was going to replace the automobile with these things. Yeah, they really thought seriously it might replace the automobile at that time. That was the impression I got anyway.
Uh-huh.
At least it was an exciting new venture, and
sure.
These fellows were going to design these vehicles that had fans directed at the ground and a big curtain around the bottom, and this directed the air down so the car could go over any terrain without benefit of roads. Well, it all came to a screeching halt, and McRae, I guess, went back to Ford.
Why did he come to a screeching halt? Because of his...
Well, it was a crazy idea to begin with. I mean, you know, you always have these guys that think they're going to revolutionize things, and I don't mean to say every new idea is not without merit, but it stands to reason if a vehicle has to waste that much energy just to stay above the ground, it doesn't have much left to propel itself forward, and. I guess it had another propeller to propel itself forward. It just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was okay for special purposes, going over swamps or something, I don't know.
Not the
no. But anyway,
I think McRae saw this as a way out of his dilemma with Churchill.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Base saving device.
But a lot of stylists really don't have their feet on the ground, you know. Sometimes I think it's even considered an asset. They don't want stylists. They think it makes them too stodgy, and I don't feel that way. But anyway, when Duncan quit, and I think Curtis Wright left the picture, then Churchill and Hardig got Randy Farrow back to head the
Who's Hardig?
Gene Hardig was chief engineer.
H-A-R-D-I-G.
D-I-G. Not D-I-N-G, as you'll read in that book.
Right.
So Randy Farrow, whom I knew from the Lowy days, was in the saddle. And now it was...
How do you spell Farrow?
F-A-U-R-O-T. It's a French name.
And he was...
Well, he was one of Bob Burke's two assistants when Burke was heading it up under Lowy, Cotto being the other assistant.
Okay. He had stayed on through all the vicissitudes.
Randy?
Yeah.
No, he I think he left when...
Burke
left? Yeah. But I don't think he went with the Lowy group. I think he went to American Motors.
I see.
I might have my time frame a little mixed up there.
Anyway, by 19, when he's back?
He's back by 1959.
Okay.
And that's when I came back. He got Ted Peach back.
Okay.
Peach had gone to American Motors.
Wait a minute, we didn't find out where you went.
Well, I was without visible means of support.
Okay. For how long?
From March of 58. To about July of 59.
Okay, good.
And,
that was everybody.
Yeah.
Who brought you back? Who made the
order? Farrow.
Oh, Farrow.
Randy Farrow.
You started to say your old buddy from GM, right? Or no, what did you say?
From Lowy.
I beg your pardon. Okay. We worked that out. Yeah. You said, come on back.
Yeah. Well, I think partly at Ted's behest also. I was a very good friend of Ted's. And
Ted has stayed on?
Well, Randy may. I think Randy had respect for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was back to Studebaker. I was fishing around at the time, trying to get out of the field altogether, because I didn't want to go back to Detroit.
Yeah.
So Randy gave Ted and myself a pretty free hand. And that was my most enjoyable period in the whole automotive career.
Yeah.
We designed all new sheet metal for a new 62 Lark. And it got so far that there were die models, wooden mahogany die models made for, I saw the die models for the hood and the front fenders.
Uh-huh.
Whether they had any more than that, I don't know. But I had heard on good authority they'd already spent about $5 million for engineering and tooling for the new model. Well, then the board of directors got off their fat duff and in New York and came to South Bend.
When you say the new model, you mean the 60 Lark?
The car we were working on, this new one, would have been the 60, all new 62.
62 Lark?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Of course, meanwhile, we were working on facelifts for 60 and 61. 61 had some fairly extensive sheet metal changes on it.
The Lark was a minor success at this point.
Well, it was a great success in 59.
That's right, yeah.
But that was before Corvair and Falcon came out.
Right.
When Corvair, Falcon, and then Valiant came out, why, there was an awful lot of competition.
Dilution. Right.
Besides Rambler, who were the first in that,
right.
in that
yeah.
field.
Mm-hmm.
And Churchill made the mistake of thinking this 59 Lark was his long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. It was just a stopgap solution, and they should have been working feverishly for a new model.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. Finally, we got the go-ahead to work on new sheet metal for 62.
Had Studebaker's fortunes improved at this point, or were they still hand-to-mouth?
Well, they improved with the 59 model. They made $29 million profit. Which was a lot of money for a small company at that time. But to tool up for this all-new 62, it would have cost them $25 million just for tooling up. That's one reason why they were loath to go ahead. They were going ahead, though.
Mm-hmm, good.
But the board of directors wasn't on their toes, and they come in after the program was this far along. $5 million in a year squandered. And now remember, we had done this job to a strict package drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And this strict package drawing was set up by Gene Hartig and Harold Churchill, who were engineers. And their attitude, if I can perhaps paraphrase it, we're going to show these stylists how it's supposed to be done.
This is Hartig and Churchill.
And keep them, we're going to keep the reins on them and keep them from... So they were going to keep us in check and keep those stylist guys from running wild. And so they give us this very stringent package with minimal front overhang.
No leeway.
Stylist likes to see a little bit of, a decent amount of overhang in front of the front wheels to develop his lines and get some character into that front sheet metal.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally allowed us an inch and a half more than the 59 Lark, which was in itself really ridiculous. It looked like it was cropped off in the front.
And, why did they do that?
Pardon?
Why did they do that?
Well, to keep the package minimum. Engineers don't like surplus sheet metal.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not contemptuous even of that, but everything can be carried to extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on an extreme in this case. Another case in point was Tumbleholm. Tumbleholm is the inward slope of the glass toward the roof.
Mm-hmm. On both front and rear?
Well, of the overall superstructure.
Yeah.
Or even the whole car, for that matter. Tumbleholm is inward slant.
Okay.
Comes from naval architecture. Well, I
talking about the Lark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe I was describing one of the limitations put on us by engineering.
Right.
And Tumbleholm was one. They limited the Tumbleholm to 10 degrees. And the reason for this, so I was told, was because General Motors has been making it 10 degrees for low all these years, and it's good enough for General Motors, it's good enough for us.
Yeah.
Of course, engineers tend to be against a lot of Tumbleholm because, there's more room inside if you have vertical windows.
Mm-hmm.
They just tend to think square.
Yeah.
And by square, I mean square, 90-degree corners. I had to go out, and I was relieved to see the Corvair come out because General Motors finally increased the Tumbleholm to 14 degrees. But I had to do all this work just to, just to stand still, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
This 40 Lincoln Zephyr we talked about had 14 degrees Tumbleholm way back in 1940, which is one of the things I liked about it, that
mm-hmm.
gives it a very stable look. Well, anyway, they restricted us on all these dimensions that stylists like to have free hands on. And the result was the car, while it would have been very saleable, it actually would have been quite timely in the last 10 to 15 years since the energy crunch.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when common sense automobiles sort of came back into vogue.
Right.
The car was not too well received by the board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
When you're used to driving a Cadillac with 2 feet of overhang on the 3 feet of overhang on the front and maybe 8 feet or 10 feet on the rear, why this car tended to look a little abbreviated,
truncated,
stunted. And in any event, they didn't have the money anyhow, so the thing was stopped right there. And, well, really, from then on, the whole Studebaker story, as I, in the words I used to describe it to someone else, it was just a series of dismal facelifts, and even more dismal facelifts on the facelifts, and in the public senses, this too. It was all downhill after that.
Very awkward for you guys.
I had a strong part in the Avanti program.
Can you tell us a bit about the
Well, Avanti's yes, it was.
Even that was the last.
The basic concept was created by Raymond Loewy and.
So Egbert ousted Churchill and brought Loewy back, in a sense, did he?
Well, I wouldn't say Egbert ousted Churchill, no. Churchill remained as a on the board of directors, I believe.
He was no longer president.
No, he was no longer president. He was sort of kicked upstairs, as they say.
Yeah. Egbert, rather dynamic personality, wasn't he?
Egbert was a very dynamic personality.
Yeah.
And but here, I guess the point I wanted to bring out was that we had had our hands tied with this very rigid package we were given to work with.
The tyranny of the engineers.
Yeah, and Churchill was an engineer.
Yeah.
And so they brought in, we were sort of in the doghouse, sort of like Mr. Gregory was in 47.
Talberg.
Well, not with Talberg, but with Breech.
Breech and Younger.
Yeah. When Walker's car won the contest.
Right.
And again, an outsider, Egbert, dynamic as he was nevertheless not an automobile man.
Where did he come from?
He came from McCulloch Supercharger.
McCulloch's right hand man?
McCulloch, anyway, in California. They made, among other things, superchargers and
all kinds of
other things. What did you ask?
Was he one of McCulloch's fair-haired boys?
I don't know. I don't think there was a McCulloch in the picture at this time.
Oh, by then.
McCulloch was, I believe, originated in Milwaukee.
Did he really?
Yes, and that's where Egbert, I believe, met Brooke Stevens.
Ah, interesting.
And that's why he brought, and Stevens was a consultant on a steam-powered car that McCulloch had something to do with.
A steam-powered car?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with the details of that. But anyway, that's one reason why Stevens was called in to assist on the passenger cars, and shortly thereafter, Loewy was called in to work on this Avanti program.
Which is to be a new top-of-the-line kind of beacon.
Right, a sales room draw.
Right.
Certainly it couldn't be sold in enough volume to save the company. But my point here is that Stevens was allowed to make some prototypes in Italy.
Yeah.
No, they were made by Sabona Bossano. That's the name of a kind of a independent outfit.
Can you spell it?
Sibona Bassano. I don't guarantee that.
It's close.
But it's close. Yeah. Italian names tend to be spelled like they sound. And they are in his museum now, this sedan, a station wagon, and a hardtop coupe.
Stevens' museum in Mequon?
In Mequon, that's right. Yeah.
M-E-Q-U-O-N.
Yeah. And he has them in his museum now. If you want to acquire those, you better make arrangements because...
What's happening?
Well, if anything happens to Brooks Stevens, and his health is poor now.
Is it going down?
The museum will be dismantled faster than you can say Jack Robinson.
I've got his son, isn't he?
His sons are not interested.
I mean, his youngest son.
Yeah.
Who's working with him now in Mexico.
I believe his two sons run this industrial design office, right next to his museum.
Right, okay, but they're not the sons that are involved in the ill-fated
Excalibur?
Excalibur.
Yes, they are.
Well, there's a younger son. There are three of them, I think.
Are there?
Yes, and there's the youngest one was when I was there, was working with his father in Mecklen. The other two were downtown, or in West Dallas, with the Excalibur. Have they since come now to Mecklen and assisting the father?
Well, the father's inactive.
What I'm trying to say is that the younger son seemed more in sync with his father than the other two.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were three.
Do you think they would dismantle that museum?
I'll tell you what I'm doing mainly is quoting a good friend of mine, Al Bonk. He used to be an employee of mine, in fact.
B-O-N-K?
B-O-N-K. And he is now the curator of the museum.
Oh, okay.
So he tells me that when Brooks goes, the museum goes.
Mm-hmm.
And Al goes.
Oh.
So he does have a vested interest in it.
Okay, good.
And he's not too concerned about it because his plans are all made.
Okay.
But he said the sons have, let's put it this way, the sons, whatever they are, two or three, have no interest in continuing it.
Ah, okay. Let's do that.
So,
it's a nice little museum collection.
Yeah. They already got rid of some of their better cars.
Have they really?
Yeah.
So Stevens is brought in.
And he was given a clean sheet of paper. He could make these prototypes any way he wanted to.
Mm.
He could put 10 foot of overhang in the front if he, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
Avanti, Loewy comes in to work on the Avanti. He was given a clean sheet of paper. He could make it any shape he wanted.
Mm.
He gave it 26 degrees tumble home. We were limited to 12, I think, finally. And that's what the Avanti had, was 26.
There's
exactly the same as the 61 Lincoln.
Really? There's some folklore that Egbert gave him a rough sketch of what he wanted.
I can't say that's true or not true. Bob Andrews says it's baloney.
Okay, good. That's
if it's rough, it's so rough you wouldn't even recognize it as an automobile.
Right.
So they... The Avanti, if you can picture an Avanti, has extreme front overhang. Most of us thought it was too much at the time, but now most cars have that type of front overhang. So we were under the thumb of engineering there, and it was a quite oppressive thumb.
In the person of?
Well, in the person of Gene Harding, I'd say, mainly.
Oh, he stayed on as
yeah.
the resident?
As a Studebaker chief engineer.
Yeah.
And I don't say there's any bitterness toward him. He was probably doing what he thought was his job, but he was really misled, I think, on some of these styling matters. Well, anyway, we were kept on, but we weren't the only, we had competition. Now, when the Avanti came along, I was happy to join the Avanti team, as it were.
Like a good group.
Yeah.
Bob Andrews, who else?
Well, what happened was that Loewy got the commission from Egbert, and he assembled around him the men that he wanted, I presume the men that he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Bob Andrews, whom you met the other night.
And who had been earlier associated with Loewy.
With Loewy, yeah. Andy's job was primarily to model, I believe, make a model of this.
Is that his nickname, Andy?
No. Well, your nickname, yes.
Okay, yeah, okay.
We call him Andy.
Sure, yeah.
His name is Robert Andrews.
Right.
Robert F. Andrews.
Right, yeah. With the omnipresent pipe.
I don't think Andy would feel fully dressed if he didn't have a pipe.
I don't think so either. He takes his bed with him.
The other fellows on the team were Tom Kellogg, and I think Tom Kellogg was the principal idea man.
Was he?
And Tom
design idea man?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom worked, I think, almost exclusively in sketching.
Okay.
And Andy, and they no doubt consulted a lot between them. Andy made the eighth size scale model of it.
Did he?
John Epstein.
The original one?
Pardon?
The original one?
The very original one.
Okay.
And... It was a rather rough model and not much detail on it.
Yeah.
And John.
Bob Cota wasn't available at this point.
No. He was working for Ford at the time.
John Epstein, or Epstein.
John Epps, I guess he called it Steen.
What do you know about him? Where did he come from?
Well, he was Lowy's. He was Lowy's man Friday.
Okay. In the design end, not necessarily Steubig.
No, right. That's the first time I'd seen him.
Yeah. Okay.
On he the Abadi project.
Must have been the New York office.
He was primarily a New York office man.
Yeah.
And I don't know that he was that much into design. I had the
administration.
Huh? Yes, I had the impression he was more in. He was sort of a gopher, you might say, for Raymond Lowy.
Sure.
And he could be trusted for Lowy anyway, and a very loyal, trusted servant.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, he'd picked up a lot of design, probably know-how too, or taste at least.
Hanging around the master.
Yeah. And he was with this group in the desert in Palm Springs.
Oh, the legendary group that went out.
Yes, the legendary group.
Sequestered in the Lowy's home in Palm Springs.
You've got the words down pat. And
I'm fascinated by this
one. Randy, meanwhile, had let me go over to the old Studebaker styling department on the fourth floor of the sixth. Randy Farrow. Oh,
okay, yeah.
He was the head of the house, the resident Studebaker the styling department.
Yeah.
My title, by the way, was chief designer.
Really?
It didn't mean a damn thing.
He let you go where?
I was a chief with no Indians.
So he sent you where?
Well, when this 62 program was axed by the board of directors, we were left hanging.
Would it have been something that would really have revitalized the line, do you think?
Well, I think it would have been.
Yeah. Not much has been written about it.
Well, it's too long a story in itself. It'll sound like I'm making excuses right and left. But
sometime you'll have to tell it.
Yeah, I'd like to actually, but I need some pictorial props.
Okay.
We were floundering like a ship without a rudder. So I knew it was coming. A lot of make-work projects and boring as heck, and you knew it wasn't going to probably amount to anything. So, on the basis of some clay modeling I had done in the past and these clay models I'd made under McCrae, which turned out pretty well, I thought very well, and some others did too. Mostly foreigners.
We mean mostly foreigners.
Well, visiting Germans and so forth from European
designers.
You know, we were connected with Mercedes by this time, and
almost took them over at one point.
And Mercedes, Daimler-Benz took over Studebaker.
No, the other way around. Didn't you? Wasn't someone thinking? Or is that another story?
Well, you might have some confusion with the Porsche story. That, too, is another story. Anyway, I approached my boss, Randy. I said, well, let's be honest, something like this.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, Randy, where we don't know. You've got a staff here now. Admittedly, a small staff, but still a staff. You don't know what to do with them. I said, I'd like to remove me from your problem list. I'd like to go over to this 69 building where the equipment is.
And 69?
Well, this is a building where we had a bigger styling department.
Oh, okay.
We were shunted all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Was this within the Studebaker complex?
Yeah. It was an old factory building right in the midst of the factory.
Oh, 69.
Yeah. And I'd like to build a 100-inch wheelbase small car there, quarter-scale model, to this design, which I showed him a line elevation of. And you know from the past experience, I can make a nice make, it'll make a nice, you'll at least have a good model out of it anyway.
Something you've been husbanding?
Pardon?
Something you've been keeping as a...
Well, it was an opportunity. I saw it as an opportunity.
Good.
And if I didn't, I might get put on designing garden tractors or floor cleaning equipment for Clark. You know, they had acquired all these subsidiaries. Eventually I did anyhow, but this postponed it. So he bought it. He says, go ahead. So I've spent the next, about the next 6 weeks making this, maybe it was more than that, maybe 2 months at least, making this model. And I was in the finishing stages of this model when I was warned. I says, they came and said, when are you going to have this done? I says, well, I can probably finish it in a week. And he said, Randy said, well, you'd better do it, because there we're supposed to have a model of this Avanti, and then we've got to blow it up into a working full-size car.
Mm. Okay.
So that's what happened. I finished the model and hurriedly, and it was cast in plaster, and a real nice model was made, and ultimately in fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
Real nice model was made out of it, which I still have, by the way.
Uh-huh. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Sam Sandifer is kind of...
Don't let that so-and-so get it. Resist.
We'll talk about that after.
Okay.
We got these sketches of Tom Kellogg's, which did give the basic Avanti theme, especially the side of the car and the superstructure, or greenhouse as they call it. And this eighth scale, this rough eighth scale model that Bob Anders had made. My job was to take that information, blow it up on a full-size draft, on a blackboard, full-size, and make sure it's to the right package dimensions. So the seating is taken care of, and we got the full headroom, front and rear, and full legroom, steering wheel clearance, and the tow board to the front wheel, and you know, everything. So everything is to the right dimensions. And blowing up an eighth scale model is quite a blow up, you know. It's really impossible to make an accurate eighth scale model. You get a scale effect. Things that look right on eighth scale, when if they were literally blown up, they become clumsy as hell on full scale. You get out of scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's one factor at work, and they didn't have full information about the dimensions we had to work with. So it was almost like starting from scratch, but I did have a theme. I was doing what I had done so successfully with instrument panels back at Ford.
Uh-huh.
And I had to make something that worked, though. So we got the basic lines laid out, the profile of the fender lines and the roof and cross-section through the front wheels, through the middle of the body, and through the rear wheels. And since they were very much in a hurry, we turned that over to the clay modelers.
Uh-huh.
Began the full-size scale model. Then we started on the interior. In the interior, I actually modeled in clay myself, the instrument panel and the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And for the seats, the management didn't know what a sports car seat was supposed to look like. So before they got any wrong ideas, I ran home and got an old Alfa Romeo Giulietta seat out of my loft in the garage. And
really?
And I was saving it for a car that I had. I brought it into work, and we actually installed that Alfa Romeo seat in the front, in the seating buck. And darn if Egbert didn't come in that afternoon right after we installed it. Well, that's why we got it in a hurry. And he sat in it and liked it. That's the seat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saw the two seats together, they are identical.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
They took templates off of this Alpha seat, and that became the Studebaker Avanti seat.
What?
I mean, the Japanese couldn't have copied it any better. Which was all right for the period. I thought it was a nice seat. What the heck? Better to have something good than to have something original, but not good. Mm-hmm. Another interesting episode, Egbert, when he got in the seating buck, he bumped his head against the windshield pillar because it was sloping so much.
Yeah,
He was about 6 foot four at least.
Yeah.
And
what was his reaction?
No, that's too bad because, well, I can't repeat his reaction here. It's not recordable.
Okay. Experts have deleted it.
Yeah. But it's too bad because Mr. Egbert, to get into most any of the contemporary cars, would have to duck his head more.
Okay.
And the Avanti, that's one of the things that dates it now, is that stiff windshield on it.
Yeah.
And it was too stiff even for that period. So Randy tried to console me. He says, well, you're going to get a longer hood out of this anyhow. Well, fine, but I'd sooner have a slope in the windshield.
Sure.
But we had to, of course, please him. And from his point of view, it was a reasonable request. And so we lengthened out the hood about an inch and a half and brought the roof forward a little, so it ended up with a stiffer windshield. But anyway, the Avanti shaped up. I won't get into some of the finer points of it, but it was a program that I had a lot to do with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Don't
probably the crown of my Studebaker period.
Don't stint.
Well, I did most of the instrument panels for Studebakers. Not only execution, but the idea concept as well.
Well, now in the case of the Avanti, Lowy did the original concept, I think. Concept drawing.
Yes.
Sketch something.
I would say so. Yes.
Yeah.
I have some of Lowy's sketches that.
Right. Okay. And then it was taken from there to what? To then who took it over?
Well, he went out in the desert there, and Kellogg made more polished,
Ray
refined
Kellogg?
Sketch. Tom Kellogg.
Tom Kellogg made the polished sketches.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Andy made the model, and then we took over.
But you were doing the fine detailing, and you were actually designing parts of the interior long before anyone else. Right?
Yeah, without benefit of any sketches.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
So
in effect, you had an awfully lot to do
with the
original design, the design of the original Avanti interior.
Well, that's virtually the whole interior.
The
I'd
whole
say.
Interior.
Yeah.
Now, this has not been recorded anywhere.
Well, yes.
We hear all about
Fred,
Andrews.
Fred
and
Fox,
and else.
Well, you know, they're
self-promoted.
Well, I don't want to.
In the best sense.
In the basic concept of the car did come, the exterior especially, did come from that group that worked on it in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were not part of that group.
No.
Because this was the exterior.
I don't want to put down their efforts.
No, not at all. But this was the exterior.
They don't put down mine.
Right.
It was a team project.
Right.
We each did what we were best at.
Mm-hmm.
And
but I suspect that in the excitement over the exterior, there's very little credit being given to those.
Fred Fox wrote an article for Special Interest Autos.
Did he?
Back in 75 on the development of the Avanti.
And he gave you credit for
it. Oh, yeah, he tells the whole thing quite
accurately. Okay, great. I'll flag that.
It has an Avanti, a red Avanti on the cover.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think it's in 75.
Good.
And I think there was a Stout Scarab on the back, cover. So, well, the Avanti didn't do that great in the marketplace either. Of course, they had all kinds of production problems with it. And for those times, I have to say, the car did look a little freaky, if I could may say so.
Oh, yeah. It was different, for sure.
It was a little bit too different.
Mm-hmm.
And some things of it weren't really. I could mention aspects of the surface development, which weren't they didn't work out the way they should have. We didn't have time enough to really.
Yeah.
In a way, that resulted in the car being as good as it does, because when a car has too long a gestation period, why there's too much time for committees to screw it up.
Right.
But if it's too short, you don't have time to work out some of the bugs in it either.
Uh-huh.
And the Avanti was fast, believe me, it was just a matter of months, a few months.
Yeah.
So, well, after Avanti, there was really, I didn't have much, do much more on Studebaker Automotive projects. I worked on floor cleaners and garden tractors, Gravely tractors. And
Gravely, how do you spell that?
G, just the way you would spell Grave, Lee.
Okay. G-R-A-V-E-L-Y.
I believe so, yeah.
Was that an established line that you had a contract for?
Ted Peach called him Gravely.
Who did?
Ted Peach. He was kind of a humorist.
Oh, is he? Yeah, right.
Or a dry sense
dry
of humor.
Dry humorist, yeah.
Gravelly tractors. I thought it was kind of clever, you know, clever perversion of the word.
Right, yeah. You had to do that to keep your sanity.
Well, that's right. Sometimes you did.
Yeah.
That Ted finally broke one day. Stevens had brought in, if I can tell this, it won't take too long.
Yeah.
Stevens had brought in a quarter scale model of this car he was going to build in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
And as I say, they gave him a completely free hand. No limits on tumble home, no limits on overhang. Put all the curved glass in that you want, do whatever you want to do, see what you can do. We never got such a similar assignment.
No.
Yeah, they breathed down our neck and they held our pencil for us.
Well, Stevens had this hokey reputation.
Well, that's right. Nothing like a good PR. But you can't do that when you work for the company.
No, of course not.
It's a manifestation of